Why are police photographing our license plates?
What are we doing for veterans returning home damaged physically and mentally, suffering from depression, homelessness, and suicide?
Why did the Supreme Court deposit corporate money into our electoral process?
Should we redefine middle class as working poor? Or is it just another Wall Street merger?
What's really behind new voter picture ID laws in certain states?
Why aren't NBC, ABC, CBS, and Fox asking these questions?
Welcome to the Reasonable Voice radio show. I'm your host, Marcello Rolando, The Reasonable Voice. The mission of The Reasonable Voice is to connect the dots between politics and finance, the need for better and more affordable education, our humanity, world peace, and of course, the arts, which we then gladly provide our listeners, the voting public, as informative food for thought to provoke their self-determination and appetite for equal economic opportunity and justice for all without truth decay. The Reasonable Voices are advocates prioritizing education, preserving our history, leading by example for a peaceful and prosperous world by evoking and embracing both creative artists and political unity as solutions to our challenges. Hello, and welcome to the Reasonable Voices News Talk Radio program. I'm your host, Marcello Rolando, The Reasonable Voice. And our reasonable voice today is my good friend and conservation biologist, Professor Guy McPherson, the world's leading expert on the risks of abrupt, irreversible climate change. Professor McPherson has been featured in several documentary films and an episode of National Geographic Explorer, that's Bill Nye's Global Meltdown. Dr. McPherson is Professor Emeritus of Conservation Biology at the University of Arizona, where he taught and conducted research for 20 award-winning years. His work has produced more than a dozen books and hundreds of articles. McPherson was among the fewer than one in 200 recipients of a Ph.D. in the natural sciences who went on to attain status as full professor. He was promoted to full professor before he turned 40 years old. Dr. McPherson is here today, and I guess if I go on and on with your introduction, we'll never have time for anything else. How are you today, Guy McPherson, Ph.D.?
I'm doing much better since that introduction. I haven't felt this good for days, so thank you.
I don't know that we've ever talked about your early years history, and I found it fascinating when I was checking you out. Not for the first time. Dr. McPherson's been on the show many times, but not recently. But I would like you to tell us, please, something about your early years. You know, I see that you were born in a small logging town in northern Idaho and include Clearwater River and the University of Idaho, of course, but also this was really caught my eye, that you were a wildland firefighter. Talk to us about all that, if you don't mind.
Sure. Yeah, I grew up in a small village in northern Idaho. It was about 3.5 hours drive from the nearest grocery store. So one of the things I learned as a youngster was be prepared for the power to go out for an extended period of time, because it did frequently. And what that meant was when we would go to the grocery store once a month, we would stock up on canned goods and other things that didn't make for very good cooking, actually. But it did teach me that you have to be prepared for the unexpected. And the power went out pretty frequently in Weipe, Idaho. And so we were prepared. Now, Weipe is known only if you've seen Ken Burns's film, The Core of Discovery. It was the Core of Discovery led by Lewis and Clark that went across the country, of course, and first met the Nez Perce Indians on the Weipe Prairie, which is where Weipe later grew up. I went to school in this small village. My dad was the principal of the elementary and middle school, and then between my junior and senior years in high school, we moved to another small town, this one a little bit smaller than Weipe, believe it or not, And it was there that I was recruited into the job as a wildland firefighter. The boss of that operation made it a point to pay attention who the good athletes were. Hmm. And I was a pretty good athlete. I was the quarterback of the football team and the defensive end. I played both ways because it was an even smaller town than Lehigh. And I also played basketball and baseball and so on. And so I was recruited by the supervisor to be a wildland firefighter. And I did that for 5 seasons, and that's what paid my way through college, was 5 seasons fighting wildland firefighters, which was a great gig. And I remember very well that my first year I got paid $4.16 an hour, and that seemed like a lot of money. And time and a half for overtime, of course, which happened a lot when we were on fires. And it was fun. And I think back to those times, and I realize that even at the time, the late 70s, early 1980s, it was one of the few jobs that anybody had where you actually depended completely upon your coworkers for your life, for your health. And so you develop a sort of camaraderie with your coworkers that I don't see in very many other positions. You know, when you depend upon somebody else for telling you that the burning log is rolling down the hill and it's going to hit you and probably kill you, if you depend upon somebody for that sort of information, if you depend upon somebody because there's a tree filled with fire that's about to fall onto you or onto the truck that you drove there, you get to be pretty close to people. You get to develop a sense of trust and this sense of camaraderie that I rarely see in other positions. So it was a wonderful way to grow up, actually.
It sounds like it. And what did you do on the Clearwater River?
Well, the Clearwater River was within our district, so I spent quite a bit of time fighting fires along the river. In addition, a friend of mine who was a firefighter in a nearby district would go with me, and we'd float down the Clearwater River in a relatively small raft. We were whitewater rafters when we were in college, and it was just two of us. Usually by the time we got more than an hour away from our launch point, he was 3 sheets to the wind, unable to provide much assistance. So fortunately we had my car parked at the far end to pick up the raft and us. We would drive back, and I'd drop in him in his small pickup and drive my small pickup away. It seems like I should have been more concerned than I was at the time about leaving a drunk man driving, but it was the nature of the world at that time.
But it was something. What was it? The Clearwater River. You did something on the river itself. You saw the last of something. I read.
Yes, that's right. The last of the log drives down the Clearwater River occurred in 1971 when I was 11 years old. After that, they built a large dam, the Dvorak Dam, which prevented that kind of activity. But what it did up until that point was allow for men. They were always men, of course, because that was the nature of the time. Mm-hmm. And they would cut down the trees elevationally well above the Clearwater River up near Weipe and Pierce and headquartered where I lived. And then they would build these flumes, these canals, as it were, that were built above ground, and they were built out of the trees that the loggers were felling, so that they would fall these trees, and then they would build these flumes that were adjacent to the creeks that were in the vicinity of where the trees were being taken down, and then they would put them into these flumes, and they would go all the way to the Clearwater River. It was several dozen miles. Wow. And then, once they got to the Clearwater River, they would assemble them onto these large rafts, and they would float down the river it was amazing, actually. There would be a cook in a canvas tent that was floating on the river, and the men would sleep in the tent, and then they'd go out during the day with their car boots, boots with that had nails poking out the bottom, and they would run and walk across these logs and corral them all day, corral them so that they would make it down the river without losing any of these expensive logs.
Yes.
It was an amazing thing to see up until I was 11 years old, and it was sort of one of those things that it's sad when it's gone, because it's in, again, one of those positions where everybody relies heavily upon everybody else on the job.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a sense of camaraderie that developed. These were the heroes when I was growing up. These men, mostly young men, who would go out with their poles, their long poles and their cart boots, and shepherd these logs downriver to Lewiston, Idaho, where there was a large-sized sawmill that could take the wood that was coming their way.
Mm-hmm. Wow, it's certainly a slice of the Americana, that's for sure. I've seen that in films, you know, of when that was done as a regular basis, but that you saw the last one really intrigued me.
Right. I provided for that as well. So it was just normal for us, which is crazy when I look back now and think about it.
Yes. I wonder, to slip into what we're really here to talk about, of course I mentioned it in the introduction, you know, you've talked about this before, the subject, I'll just say, abrupt climate change. And of course, that adjective is what everyone should hear, abrupt climate change. And the first time you said that on my show, which is years ago now, I thought, wow, that's going to scare people. Well, it didn't scare them enough, I guess. And I have to say that, you know, the first time on your show, I knew you knew what you were talking about, but to internalize it and to also think, aha, I get this, I know what this needs now, was something I sort of took for granted foolishly and naively. But I do know in my own experience now, as I watch the weather more and more, and as the weather is doing, you know, people say, boy, the weather's crazy. Or I would always say, or for a while, there are no more seasons. I even said that to you once, and you went, how wise you are, Marcello. And I didn't realize what you were saying was the real warning in that, not so much what I said, but your response to it. But there are no seasons anymore, and that has gotten clearly worse since our first conversation a few years ago. And now, I mean, I saw the most foolish thing. I know I'm rambling, but I'll get there, Guy. The most foolish headline after 2 or 3 weeks ago when the Canadian fires started to affect our breathing air. The most foolish headline I saw in an American newspaper was, "Blame Canada." And I thought, exactly, I thought, oh my God. Oh my God, you really don't get it, do you? So after all of that, my question is, why all of a sudden, in quotes, I'll say, is climate change seeming to me, anyway, to be truly on the road to being what you call abrupt?
Well, even the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which according to a blog post written by Princeton professor Michael Oppenheimer, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, was designed to fail. It was set up during the Reagan administration, and it was designed specifically to prevent activism and positive changes that might allow us a way out.
Mm.
Even the IPCC concluded in its October 8, 2018 report, Global Warming of 1.5 Degrees, that climate change was abrupt. In fact, here's the signature line, quoting two peer-reviewed papers. "Even abrupt geophysical events do not approach current rates of human-driven change." In other words, what we are witnessing, what we are living through, is the most abrupt environmental change in planetary history, as nearly as we can tell.
Hmm.
So it's more abrupt than when the asteroid struck the Earth and caused the extinction of the dinosaurs some 66 million years ago. More abrupt than that. That's what humans have done collectively with our ability to transform carbon from within trees and fossil fuels and put it into the atmosphere where it serves as a nice greenhouse gas to warm up the planet. Now, that's not all. That's the October 8th report from the IPCC, Global Warming of 1.5 Degrees. Then less than a year later, September 24th, 2019, the IPCC, in its IPCC special report on the ocean and cryosphere and a changing climate, concluded that an overheated ocean was responsible for the irreversibility of climate change. So here we have two reports by this organization that was designed to be very conservative scientifically, mm-hmm. and two reports in less than 1 year concluded that climate change is abrupt and irreversible, more abrupt than any time in the history of the planet, and irreversible. And that was all accomplished by September of 2019. And every day I hear that I'm odd because I report that climate change is abrupt and irreversible. And therefore, I'm discouraging people from taking actions that would fix the situation we're in.
Hmm.
This happened most recently in the Washington Post. Not most recently of this ever happening, mind you, but it happened most recently in the Washington Post
uh-huh.
on Friday the 24th of March, 2023, when it was concluded by a libelous statement that I'm a horrible person for pointing out that climate change is abrupt and irreversible. And all I've been doing for many years is reporting on the work of other people, in this case, the incredibly scientifically conservative IPCC. So it shouldn't come as a big surprise, folks, but apparently it is for some people.
Well, I think, sadly, that people, I mean, everywhere, it isn't just an American thing, although I think we do it better than most, just simply ignore what we don't want to hear. You know, when you can always change the channel. You don't even have to walk to the television anymore, or the computer, or the cell phone, and you just turn away from technologically, and you turn away physically and unrealistically, I guess, what distracts you from all the fun. I think there's a certain amount of eat, drink, and be merry even among people who admit to themselves that something is going on. I mean, the truth is the truth. There's no running away from the truth that we can pretend, but what else can we do? If people are accusing you that you're a bad guy because, I didn't mean that as a pun, because you tell us the truth, and how does it set us free? How's that for a question?
Yeah, well, to know that climate change is abrupt and irreversible actually is very liberating for some of us.
Mm-hmm.
It tells us that there is nothing I can do as an individual to fix this unfixable situation. And what does that mean for me? It means that I'm not going to go get arrested when I'm out protesting. I think that's among the most ridiculous things humans are doing in light of this unfixable situation. Going out and getting arrested, thrown in jail. I've heard of many people who've done exactly that because they want to fix it. And I understand. I want to fix it too. But according to one of the more scientifically conservative bodies, perhaps the most conservative scientific body in the history of the planet, it's not fixable. It's abrupt and it's irreversible, and it has been for years. And you know, it took a long time for the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change to reach this conclusion, but we're there. And what does that mean for you and me and how we live our lives? I think it, for me at least, it tells me that living with urgency is an even better idea than when I first heard the idea many years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Because, as Homer pointed out in the Iliad a couple thousand years ago, any moment might be our last.
Yes.
And that certainly applies at the individual level. You know, there's a lot of dangerous things about life in America, life in any first world country, certainly life in lesser developed countries. You could suddenly disappear at any time, and you're not getting any of your life back. So live for today. Live here now. That's been my message for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
This did not mean in any way giving up. Rather, I'm informing people what the facts are, and they include that the notion of living with urgency, because your life is short. I don't care if you live to be 115 years old.
Mm.
And most people alive today certainly won't. Your life is still short. I remember when I was on tour in 2015 in Western Europe, and when I was on this tour, a woman became the oldest person in the world. She turned 117, and at her 117th birthday party, she was asked to respond to the notion of being 117 years old. What does that mean to you? And she says, it seemed rather short.
Mm. Oh, wow. We're going to stop there. Wow. 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 What a... Absolutely. It's in a blink of an eye. It does not measure at all. Not that it doesn't have value. That's not my point. But it doesn't make an imprint when you consider the whole of life on Earth and all that's come before us. Anyway, I think that's a great high point on which to take a break. So we're going to take a break so I can catch my breath and everything else. This is magnificent. It always is, Guy. And I think if we know, many people can make many choices, as we both of us have actually said. But I think the point is, the next moment has never been promised to us. So let us live a good life. Let us try to make that choice. Let us love each other. Let us do things for each other and together. Anyway, we'll see. We'll be right back with Professor Guy McPherson. And we're going to talk more about the conservative point of view of what's going on with our climate and the condition of Earth and what we have, at least our parents and grandparents, have bequeathed to us, and now we bequeath to our children. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Marcello Rolando of Rolando and Dresner Productions, introducing our new musical dramedy, A Little Place Called Earth, book by Marcello Rolando and music and lyrics by Larry Dresner. And here, from A Little Place Called Earth, is It Will All Work Out. Music and lyrics by Larry Dresner.
My life was nice and cozy, with the sun around me. Then I felt a raindrop, and the skies were suddenly all cloudy. Now here I'm standing in the rain, no umbrella, no overcoat, no money, sometimes forced to sing in a cappella. Before you lose your temper and your mind gets in a flurry, just tell yourself, no, honey, never cry and never, never worry. It'll all work out. It can't rain forever. It'll all work out somehow. Chance to reach that brass ring. No matter what the weather, you can always sing and sing and sing. The minute I start singing a refrain soft and mellow, a big loud band comes marching, and the tuba fella starts to bellow. I don't know what to do now. Everything's gone crazy. I don't know where to go now. My dream has gotten dim and hazy. Sometimes you're dealt a bad hand, but you keep on playing. I know you're not a quitter. Listen now to what I'm saying. It'll all work out. It can't rain forever. It'll all work out somehow for the better if you just keep hanging on. There'll always be another chance to reach that brass ring. No.
For more information, listen to our Rolando and Dresner Productions podcast on YouTube at Marcello Rolando, The Reasonable Voice. Thank you.
Welcome back to The Reasonable Voice's News Talk Radio program. I'm your host, Marcello Rolando, The Reasonable Voice. And we have been talking with PhD Guy McPherson about abrupt climate change. It's not a theory. He has some very conservative scientific institutions that agree with him, like the IPCC. First of all, the IPCC is scientifically conservative, as both Dr. McPherson and I have mentioned, according to the conservative peer review literature. So the rate of environmental change underlies the ability of populations and communities and species to adapt. And you mentioned that a bit, Sky, in the last segment. I wonder if you could expound on that.
Yes, absolutely. It is the rate of environmental change that dictates whether we survive or not, and not just us, but all life on the planet, and not just species, but populations as well. So every species on the planet evolved through natural selection to be with the cohort of other species it's with in the physical environment it is in, that experiences certain high temperatures, low temperatures, rainfall events, and so on. So through almost certainly dozens and perhaps thousands of generations, every species has adapted to a specific set of environmental conditions. This is why some species are so rare. For example, there are species in the Arctic or the Antarctic that are found only there because that's such an unusual set of physical conditions for those species. And the same applies to everywhere on the planet. When a new species comes in and encounters species that it has never encountered before, and that these new species are encountering for the first time this new species, that often leads to environmental changes that are quite profound. For example, when a non-native or a non-indigenous species is introduced, and this happens many, many times accidentally, It'll come in and find a new species that's never found before that it can prey on, that it can eat, that it can somehow provide habitat. So think about the American chestnut, for example, which is essentially extinct as a result of a small organism that was brought over on a ship. And immediately, because the American chestnut was not familiar with this new species, it had no defense for it. So no defense had developed over evolutionary time. It was if this new species comes in and says, oh, ice cream, and it just destroys the species, and there's no defense. So this has happened over and over again with non-indigenous species that are introduced to a new space. And you could argue that an analog is the human species that started out in Africa and then spread throughout the globe. Everywhere we went, we destroyed many populations and ultimately species in our new habitat.
Yes.
Because we're doing what other species have done, taking full advantage, living large, eating whatever we could, destroying whatever it took to allow us to make a little money and have a little bit more privilege in our lives. So, you know, it shouldn't come as a big surprise, but then you add it all together, you put it all together over several thousand years, and of course this is what happened. Of course we have overheated the planet. Of course we have driven species to extinction. Of course we have fouled the air and dirtied the water. How could we not, knowing what we know and desiring what we desired?
Yes.
I mean, you know, we can look back and place all kinds of blame on previous generations of humans, but it would be difficult for me to accept the idea that I wouldn't have done the same thing my parents and grandparents did.
That's true.
Which from their perspective was trying to make a better life for me.
Yes. Yes, that's true. But every time we have a conversation, no matter how much time elapses between, you make me think about our ancestors who came before us. We are, after all, doing the same thing they did, and it is for life, liberty, and a pursuit of happiness. But let's take this out of America for a moment, because I think things go extremely well for us when compared to the rest of the world. So we tend to be a little more aloof or doubting. What about what's going on right now with agriculture? If we could slip to that just a bit. I understand that indigenous people elsewhere, far away from our thoughts and our view, are losing their land because we are American organizations and corporations are taking the land to use it for more food, to produce more food for the Western world, not just America, to be able to eat. And those indigenous people are being pushed further and further away without their land. So if the land goes, so does the source of food. And we are doing that to ourselves. Am I overstating, understating, or am I even correct?
No, you're right on. Every civilization so far, including industrial civilization, the current model, depends heavily upon the ability to grow, store, and distribute grains at a large scale. Mm. If we were not able to grow wheat, soy, corn, called maize in the rest of the world, and so on, then we wouldn't have this set of living arrangements, pure and simple. If we cannot store a bunch of food in the form of grains, which is the easy way to store food, then we would have a very difficult time holding together this set of living arrangements. And this has been the case for dozens of civilizations that preceded this one. And a few of those civilizations, by the way, when they collapsed, because ultimately they had too many people trying to eat that food that they had stored, when they collapsed, the survivors came back and said, we're not going to do that again.
Mm.
This is with the Membres, with the Olmec, and undoubtedly with other civilizations through time, that the survivors looked around, saw what they had done, saw that they came to depend upon this stored grain. They went into population overshoot at the local or regional level and stripped away their ability to survive. So they said, we're not doing that anymore. As much privilege as there is with grains that you can store for extended periods of time, they determined that it just wasn't worth it. Well, here we are a few thousand years later, and it's probably a little too late to make that change ourselves.
I see. Isn't there a country that actually has built a wall around it because of the fear of migration, the more that food is scarce?
Yeah, do you mean the United States?
I knew you were going to say that. You know, and I thought of it when I asked the question. But no, it's some other land. But let's put it back in the United States. There is no doubt, except for people who choose not to pay attention. And I have many, many friends I love dearly living in the state of Florida. But Florida is losing ground every day. If the ocean doesn't take it over before we run out of food, those are our choices as I see it. And I'm no PhD in the subject, so we'll ask Dr. McPherson. But also, Manhattan, my favorite place to live, is sinking under its own weight. And people say, well, that's the building. That's not our fault. Well, the buildings are there because of the way of life we choose to nurture and the way we go about building civilization. And I'll throw that out and say it's a question, Guy, for you.
Yes, absolutely. You know, the mark of civilizations is the buildings, the cities.
Mm-hmm.
The cities that depend upon water and food from elsewhere.
Yes.
To survive. You can't go to Manhattan, look around, and select from the nearby organic farmer field what you're going to eat for dinner today. It doesn't work. The grains are grown in the Midwestern United States and in Canada and in Ukraine, and I think that might have something to do with why we're actually in Ukraine. So it's these grains grown elsewhere, South America, Asia, everywhere, that are so important to the set of living arrangements. And so, of course, the world's most lethal killing force is going to make sure that we have access to those grains so that you and I can experience some more comfort in places like Manhattan. And for people not able to make wise choices, including myself for a year and a half living in Florida.
Well,
there are places that are already showing signs of decay of this set of living arrangements. They shouldn't come as a surprise. And you just can't keep going forever. Entropy ensures that systems break down, and this set of living arrangements is certainly breaking down.
You know, and I know you've said this, and I'm not trying to be funny or insult anyone, but let's explain a little more. The rapid speed of environmental change is outstripping the ability of vertebrates and mammals to adapt. Now, as I say that, remembering you said that to me before on other shows, what does that mean exactly?
Well, here's one example. It's from a peer-reviewed paper written in 2013 by Quintero and Weens, and I can't remember the journal off the top of my head, but they indicated that the projected rate of change into about 100 years into the future outstrip the ability of vertebrates to adapt by a factor of 10,000 times. The rate of environmental change that we are currently experiencing and that we are likely to experience in the relatively near future outstrips the ability of vertebrates to keep up by a factor of 10,000 times. Think about that for a minute. We're vertebrates, changing so rapidly that vertebrates can't keep track. And then later research in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences indicated that mammals can't keep up either. Well, we're vertebrates and we're mammals. That should give us some pause, some indication that we ought to be concerned about what's going on and what faces us in the future. But I just don't see very many people concerned about it. And maybe that's okay. I've been pounding this drum of abrupt irreversible climate change since June 20th, 2012. And I don't think I've influenced the way that people live for more than a half a dozen people. And it's proven hugely problematic in terms of my own personal relationships with my family and former friends. And so maybe it's just a bad idea to talk about this stuff, that some truth is just too much for most humans to handle.
I'm going to jump in on that. Let's take it to this level. What you've been talking about, how we as a human species, vertebrates and mammals, how we respond to what you have been talking about, I think is a measure, as you have said in the past, of our character, our individual beliefs, our faith, in whatever it is we believe in, whether it's the almighty dollar or the almighty God or whatever it is, how we feel about each other and society. But what always nails me to the wall whenever I think about, and as you know, I spend a lot of time thinking about this, not studying so much about it as you, because I can call you up and get you on the radio, but I think about, what are we thinking about our children and our grandchildren? What possibly those who refuse to change their demands on Earth, their expectations, their assumptions that this is forever. What are we thinking about the children and grandchildren? I remember, and I'll let you talk, I promise. I remember in the last show we talked about, it must have been 2021-ish or so, because I know it was, because something was going on, it was really changing, and you said, well, this, and you quoted one of your many sources, conservative scientific sources, and you said, well, here's something about 2022, which is almost here, Margiello. I never will forget that phrase. What does it say about our character, our thoughts, our faith, our morals, when we are, if we are among those who simply disregard what's happening within our lifetime to our grandchildren?
That's a great question. And when I was in a classroom, at the front of the classroom, somebody would ask me a question, I'd say, that's a great question. It almost always meant that I didn't know the answer. But I'm going to plunge away anyway. John Kenneth Galbraith, the Canadian-American social butterfly, if you will,
yes,
wrote his 1977 book, The Age of Uncertainty. In the first chapter, he wrote, "People of privilege will always risk their complete destruction rather than surrender any material part of their advantage."
Hmm.
And so I think that's part of it. Because we're in this civilization, within this set of living arrangements, and we manage to find a way to eat and drink water every day, we are those people of privilege.
Yes.
And it's difficult to ask individuals, most of whom have hard days anyway, to give up more. And if the billionaires won't give up more, won't give up anything, then what does that say about the rest of us and what should be expected of us? You know, it's pretty hard when you have presidents, prime ministers, world leaders who are flitting about in their private airplanes and merely taking the lead of the billionaires and encouraging similar activity by billionaires. Then what can you expect of you and me, of the populace, in terms of making significant changes that will ensure that we have more generations in our future? You know, I think it's amazing we made it this far, given the way that humans have lived for my entire life, and as nearly as I can tell, before then.
Mm-hmm. You know, that's a good point, too, that we've made it as far as we have is a blessing, but it's a blessing that keeps us deaf, dumb, and blind. What are your thoughts?
Yes, that's right, it does. Because as human animals, we tend to think that the near future will be very similar to the recent past.
Yes.
And the past, for folks like you and me, has been great. Mm. How could you not like this? And so we think it's going to be great in the future no matter what we do. But, of course, individual cases, commonly nominated for the Darwin Awards, indicate otherwise.
All right. We've always ended before on an upbeat, positive note. I don't know that... I think the most positive and upbeat thing we can say is that, and not I told you so, but I suppose some people would take it that way. If we, you and I, and people like us, who are trying to do something beyond protesting, rather changing life rather than trying to protest so someone else external from you will change life, I wonder if the only up thing is that to say, live a life worthwhile. I think you've said words like that. Live a life worth living, but people translate that in very different ways. How do we... I mean, if it's over and you believe you have to go and make some account, you know, in the clouds or whatever, and I don't make fun of anyone's beliefs, I'm Roman Catholic, I feel that there is an accountability somehow. If that accountability only is at some point we have to look over our shoulders, or I should say not over our shoulders, but out into the distant future, and realize those that are much younger than I will have a very different earth, if an earth at all. That's not very upbeat, is it?
Well, how about this? How about the ultimate authority, the face in the mirror at the end of the day?
Yes.
I'd like to be able to say, even though I have no children, that was a decision I made when I was 19 years old in 1979. Even though I have no children, I don't want to leave a lifeless planet in my wake.
Mm.
I want to give future generations of human beings, or even current generations of human beings, the means to live a decent life. And here's the good news that you were looking for, that we always find a way to present.
Please.
James Anderson, the Harvard atmospheric scientist famous for discovering the link between chlorofluorocarbons and the Antarctic ozone hole, said in an interview with Forbes on January 15th, 2018, quote, "The chance there will be permanent ice in the Arctic after 2022 is essentially zero," end quote. And then Jennifer McKinnon comes along, almost 3 years later, and she's at the University of California, San Diego, and interviewed by CBS News on April 23rd, 2021, she says she expected an ice-free Arctic Ocean last year.
Hmm.
Well, it didn't happen.
It didn't happen.
And it's not going to happen this year either.
I'll take it.
James Anderson was wrong. We have currently, and this has only been around for a couple of years, we have the U.S. Naval Postgraduate School's six-month ensemble forecast, which has been stunningly reliable and conservative, and it indicates that we will have about 5 million square kilometers of ice floating on the Arctic Ocean on the minimum day, which they predict will be on September 17th. So good news, two very informed people have predicted an ice-free Arctic Ocean last year and this year, and it's almost certainly not going to happen. Why is that important? Because the rate of change, the rate of environmental change in the wake of an ice-free Arctic Ocean will be faster than anything this planet has ever experienced. It would be the equivalent of putting 25 trillion tons of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, essentially overnight. It didn't happen last year. It's not going to happen this year with great certainty. We have great reason to be grateful for getting another year or two or three. We don't know, but every day is a blessing and a reason to express gratitude. I don't think we need any more than that.
I think that's something we definitely need to do, to be grateful, because I get the feeling, as you tell us, that it's like something, some force of universe, natural, supernatural, whatever, but some force has said, I'm going to extend the deadline. Now, what we do with it is up to us. And I'll take that as a positive.
Absolutely. What we do with it, let's live with integrity. Let's live with gratitude.
Yes.
Let's live with love for the people around us.
Yes.
Even for ourselves.
Yes. Well, Guy, Dr. Guy McPherson, PhD, it's always a pleasure to talk to you, because I believe knowledge is power. Knowledge gives us choice. And our conversations just become more and more meaningful to me and to all of us who are listening, I'm sure. It's so great to hear your voice again and to have this conversation. And I'm glad you let us know that we got a little more time.
The pleasure is all mine, as always.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Take care. I know we'll be in touch, and I look forward to the next time, okay?
As do I.
All right, then. Bye now. To hear more from our Reasonable Voice guest today, Guy McPherson, PhD, visit his website at guymcpherson.com. That's GUYMCPHERSON.com. You may also want to visit his Nature Bats Last YouTube channel.
And now, from WatchFireMusic.com, vocal artist Jenny Burton, singing Who Will Heal the World?
Broken-hearted, build the families, give back the dignity that's now been taken away. Who will heal the world? Who will bridge the waters? Who will break the barriers between men? Now you know the task he gives.
Hi, I'm Marcello Rolando, the Reasonable Voice. Thanking you for joining us and becoming one of the reasonable voices heard round the world. For every supreme right-wing action, there must be an equal love thy neighbor as thyself opposite reaction. If not, the trajectory of America's history, 2 steps forward, 1 back, becomes 2 steps back and maybe 1 wounded morally by an ever-increasingly politicized Supreme Court and GOP House of Non-Representatives, determined to toss America backwards into the quicksand of fearing cultural diversity, racial equality, and every gender's freedom of choice. Mansion-hunting, supremely conservative jurists and soul-losing GOP state legislators in search of their whoopee-coyote motherlode dream are now overcast in the shadow of self-serving interpretations, dimming any declaration of independence into the murky muck and mire of the vapid self-righteous hypocrites spouting hordes of misinterpretations of both First and Second Amendments. So, we, with past memory, present discernment, and future vision, although stunned, must exclaim aloud with every vote, America, you're in danger, girl. Sadly, trumped or not, most Americans know less truth about America's history, Bill of Rights, and 14th Amendment than nationalized citizens, Bible sworn to an allegiance to our Constitution. Yet, if we investigate more than corporate-owned media investigates, we will experience a reality check that frees us from following the prompts of the unseen power over the bought, the borrowed, and bewildered willing to be bamboozled. And thus came the supreme triple hitter against American LGBTQ, affirmative action, and forgiven student loans, an inevitable tentacle of Rove Citizens United. For if corporations are people, can desert hypotheticals be far behind? Yet, it's not fair, is wasted energy and self-defeating. Even if unable to let go during the memorable parading out of our selective whitewashed memories of past rocket's red glare celebrations, with each dawn's early light, our best choice is to rise anew to we hold these truths to be self-evident that all have never been equal and will never be equal until we dispel every big lie we've been told and magnified in our retelling is silenced with our apocalyptic ballots voting cease and desist to all hypocrites and violent reactionaries, insulting our collective emancipation from those who, despite and to spite all historical evolution, insult any woman's right to choose, any straight, lesbian, gay, trans, or queer's right to be, any current student's freedom from debt now available, although not so before a 21st century presidential hope to correct multiple centuries of neglect and disparaging disparity that seek heils our American flag while desecrating all for which it stands, even if imperfectly and inconsistently. Quoting now, in the 1960s, the average cost of tuition and fees at any 4-year college increased at an annual rate of 6.1%. Undergraduates attending University of Pennsylvania, for example, in the 2021-2022 academic year will pay $61,170, a 373.9% increase over 1959's equivalent costs, that is, $12,907, unquote. How impervious, self-absorbed, even one might say vengeful to resent college students receiving help now that was unavailable in our recent past. If a presidential helping hand were allowed to lift some of the weight off the shoulders of 21st century students who will be challenged to overcome the calamitous condition of Earth's air, water, and environment, will we, the high and mighty, emulating those deeming themselves supremely superior, deny America's future leaders such help?
Apart from slavery, McCarthyism, and the blatant bigotry of Trump's wall, there's little more anti-American idealistic exceptionalism than wishing that those who follow us be worse off than we. I can't imagine my grandmama, whose formal education ended at the 7th grade, so she could help on the family farm, resenting or even complaining because I was able to attend the Peabody Conservatory of Music, Towson State University, and earn my Master's of Fine Art from the Catholic University of America. So, until we, the privileged, are secure enough in ourselves, our lives, and our accomplishments, too, on the way up the ladder of success, reach back and give a hand up to the person behind us whose climb has historically been a greater challenge than ours ever was. All of us are in danger of succumbing to the burning and banning of knowledge's power. Perhaps, if we focus more on what we need to do and must be, rather than what we didn't get, those who follow will have a chance to breathe free on a planet desperately trying to survive our overindulgences. Maybe our first step toward an equal opposite reaction to our current ill-conceived SCOTUS, aided and abetted by House Republicans, is to prioritize our life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness with giving while living whatever we can to historically black colleges and universities, foundations and nonprofits that have a proven record for financially helping all of God's children, black men and white men, Jews and Gentiles, Protestants and Catholics, and all Asian, Latinx, LGBTQ, female, and Native Americans of any age, skin hue, faith, or politics. Then, perhaps, life on Earth after us may be forgiving. I'm Marcello Rolando, the Reasonable Voice, and I know where my voice belongs. I wish the same for you. Thank you, and join us. Become one of the Reasonable Voices heard round the world.
Thank you for continuing to listen to, support, and share the Reasonable Voice Blog Talk Radio with family and friends, especially online. We enjoy hearing from you, and in response, yes, we are now accepting new company and business advertisers and welcoming organizations seeking to be one of our sponsors. So please do continue to email us at thereasonablevoice@gmail.com. However, if you prefer to simply make a donation, your donations are greatly appreciated and can be made through PayPal by clicking on the donate button found at the top of the homepage of the Reasonable Voice. Website.
Thank you for joining us today to make every day as reasonable as possible. We hope you will download and share our downloadable podcasts. I'm Marcello Rolando, the Reasonable Voice, hoping you will become one of the reasonable voices heard round the world.